My name is Kevin Lane. I'm the Senior Technical Sales Support Manager for the Americas, North and South America, for Fermentis, particularly focusing on beer and hard seltzer, as much as I don't want to admit that. So today we're going to talk about a new yeast strain that Fermentis is just releasing this week, which is called Saffirelli 02. It is our second yeast strain for non-alcoholic beer production with standard brewing design, standard brewing mashing, standard recipe. As I'm sure you're all aware, probably why you're here, it's a growing segment, one of the best growing segments currently. Where to begin? So I just arrived back to the United States on Friday. I was down in Chile for an industrial application, actually of the LA01. It was fascinating. Got to see a national park and hike a mountain for 5.5 hours, which sounds great, but you end up really sweaty and tired and sore for the rest of the week. And we did that on Sunday, right after we had arrived. But I was down there with a colleague, and we got to talking on one of the many two-hour drives that we had that week, and he said, you know, I was looking at pictures and last night, and I saw that the last time that we came to Chile together was also April. And I was like, oh, that's strange. It was like within 6 days of one another, but 2 years ago. And at the end of the trip, you know, I was thanking him. I was thanking the brewers that we had met with on the last day. And I was like, thank you. This has been a fantastic trip. And they said, great. We'll see you next fall. Okay, some people got that. Southern Hemisphere, April is fall. All right, I knew that wasn't going to land. It's called an icebreaker, everybody. And I have no problem making a fool of myself. So let's get back to this. I know you didn't come to listen to stories about my travels and Chile. But so again, this is a second offering for you as brewers to make non-alcoholic beer through fermentation. And, of course, there are many ways to make non-alcoholic beer. There's filtration, there's distillation, there's many different ways of mechanically treating beer that's alcoholic. But in all of those practices, you're altering the chemistry of the beer. You usually have to do some sort of treatment to get it back in line with tasting like beer after you go through the process. Those can be very CapEx investments, very big CapEx investments, and also the operation of them is quite energy and water intensive. And really, that's going to be based on operator time. So it's not just the fermentation, it's the fermentation and then additional work afterwards. We don't work in mechanics, we don't work in equipment, we work in microbiology. So we said, okay, there are a variety of options out there. We did research. We were looking up different literature-based strains, whether it's Saccharomyces or not, for producing NA beer. And I think the nice part about the non-alcoholic beer through fermentation is also you're not restricted by having to run another piece of equipment after a fermentation. You're just doing a fermentation. It's rather fast, and we'll see that later. And then you have a beer that, as long as you preserve it, because it's a very delicate beer, especially in a brewery if you're also producing alcoholic beer, that you have to preserve it and be very mindful of what's happening. You know, there's a different safety guidelines for serving. I happen to sit on the board for the MBAA and Brewery and Food Safety, the committee. And it seems like every month when we have our phone call, non-alcoholic beer comes up, whether that's serving, whether that's there was a mishap, I think, 3 months ago that it was a contract manufacturer that put an alcoholic beverage into what was supposed to be just a water bottle. And that has some significant impact on business. Fortunately, they were able to identify where it came from, and they isolated that material and destroyed it. But, you know, really when you're working with non-alcoholic beer, you're trying to provide that non-alcoholic beer to your customer. And you don't want to deliver them an alcoholic beer if you say it's non-alcoholic. So you have to be very mindful of what you're doing, with the product after this primary fermentation. So this Saffbrewelli 02 is actually a Torulospora delbrueckii. It's a non-Saccharomyces, our first option, our first offering, which is about 8 years old now. LA01, that was a Saccharomyces cerevisiae variety chevaliari, so it's a subclass of Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which hopefully all of you know should be pretty standard for brewers. Essentially, what we're focusing on with the fermentation side is to find a maltose-negative strain. What that means is that the strain is only able to ferment the simple sugar. It doesn't have the transporters for maltose, maltotriose, anything beyond that. Hopefully is not diastatic, because that would ruin the whole intention. With LA02, it is interesting that it is invertase positive. It's invertase active, but really slow and really easy to manage that side. Of course, it's only going to be active on sucrose, so it's not really that big of a concern. But in a typical mash with malt, we're not talking about adjuncts because those are going to be very fermentable sugars typically. With a standard mash, you're going to have roughly 10 to 15% glucose, fructose, simple sugars. Beyond that, you have maltose, maltotriose, and dextrins that are going to make up the bulk of the carbohydrate profile of the wort. And what's a very important thing to remember is that Saccharomyces cerevisiae, your ale yeast, or Saccharomyces pastorianus, your lager yeasts, are going to be very happy in an environment that has all the maltose and maltotriose. They're not as happy with that, but they're still happy with it. So this is going to be a very fast fermentation, only going to achieve the 10 to 15% attenuation, depending on the strain and on your brewing process, what you're giving to the yeast, what you're making available to the yeast. Of course, if you manipulate the mash or you add adjuncts or whatever you're doing, you add an enzyme, you'll change the carbohydrate profile. But typically in a standard mash with all malt, you're going to have roughly 10 to 15% glucose or simple sugars. Therefore, with a maltose negative strain, you're going to have 10 to 15% attenuation. So when we take a look at kind of typical ale yeast here, we have SAF LUS05, it's Chico ale yeast. I think every yeast supplier has one. If they don't, they're making a mistake. Very widely used around the world, and that's going to have an attenuation around 80%, give or take 2-3 up or down. With LA01, that was our release 8 years ago, you can see it's about 15% attenuation, 13 to 15. So really, you're looking at a very significant difference in residual carbohydrates available after this primary fermentation. And Saccharomyces in general are very happy with maltose. So it's 50 to 60% maltose. There's only 0.2 to 0.5 ABV from this primary fermentation. So there's no real obstacle for the Saccharomyces to implant. And even in small amounts, we'll be very happy and flourish and grow and make an alcoholic version of what you want to be a non-alcoholic version. When looking at something like non-alcoholic beer, it's the same way that you can look at anything for safety. So what I mean by that is I saw a really interesting presentation from our CEO of the North American subsidiary, and it was, I think, during the pandemic and kind of giving us guidelines as to how to live life and still remain safe. And his graphic that he put up was slices of Swiss cheese. So you have holes in each slice. There's no one protection that's perfect. But if you stack enough of those slices of cheese together, you have a solid wall, or hopefully mostly solid wall, that you won't be having that cross-contamination of your body through. And the same thing goes with beer. So when you have a non-alcoholic beer, you want to have those layers of protection so you don't have a cross-contamination and infection that's going to change your beer. Again, remember, you're trying to deliver to your customer a non-alcoholic beer. You're saying it's 0.5 ABV or less. And the reason, not only for flavor stability, for delivering the product that you want to the customer, there's also reasons that people choose non-alcoholic beer. I'm not one of them. I like the good old-fashioned ethanol-filled, let's get a little bit dizzy, guys. That's my style beer, but there are people that choose non-alcoholic beer. And we see that growing worldwide. And that can be for many reasons. It can be for dietary health. It can be because a woman is pregnant, and we know that there's consequences to consuming ethanol when you're pregnant. It could be a designated driver that wants to go with their friends and enjoy a good time out at a bar, but they said to their friends, I'll drive you home. I'll be safe. I will not drink alcohol. And there's something about beer that just makes an experience, right? So having an option for a designated driver, for somebody who's pregnant, for somebody that is intolerant of alcohol, there's allergies to ethanol, that you have an option for them to still enjoy that occasion, that social activity of drinking a beer with their friends or with their family or whoever it is, or if it's my case, maybe by myself. I don't know. I don't have too many friends. But that was a joke also. That one didn't hit. That one really missed. Worse than my Southern Hemisphere joke at the beginning. But what I'm trying to say is you're trying to deliver a non-alcoholic product to your customer. You're saying it's 0.5 or less. They should be receiving something 0.5 or less and know, have faith in you that it's conforming to those guidelines or the label claim. Now, when we look at LA02, really this is going to be limited at about 10% attenuation. So to begin with, it's 10% attenuation versus LA01 having 13 to 14, maybe 15, depending on the matrix. So already a lower percentage fermentable or fermented by this strain. But also LA02 is less efficient at producing ethanol from carbohydrates. So where LA01, and I think I've got it on the next slide, so I won't talk about that now. But whenever Fermentis comes out with a new product, we try to do applied research beforehand so that we can understand and we can communicate with you what you should expect. Sometimes, like LA02, I've never tasted a beer made with it. I'm hoping I might get to sample one later today. That's on the down low. Don't tell anybody. I'm going to go raging on some NA beer. But, you know, usually we try to have an understanding so that we can communicate with you the expectation from the strain, what flavor profile, what should or should not happen from this strain. So we do a lot of applied research in our pilot brewery, which is rather new, very shiny stainless steel in the north of France. But this is just one example of some research that we were doing when we identified this Torula spora as our next offering for NA beer. And as you can see, we were tracking fermentation. I think that there was a weekend somewhere from day 3 until day 5 where, unfortunately, people don't like to work on weekends. I seem to have no trouble doing it, but I'm crazy. But we have really a fairly standard curve. But notice this fermentation is really occurring in the first 3 or 4 days, and then it's plateauing. So that's the end of the primary fermentation. Also only achieving 0.25% ABV with an 8-plato wort. That's rather low ethanol from 8-plato. And that just shows the inefficiency of the strain to produce ethanol from the carbohydrate base. In comparison, this is research that we did with LA01. Again, 8 years ago when we released this strain, we were doing applied research at the time with that strain. And you can see that to reach 0.5 ABV, you have to be somewhere between 6 and 7 Plato. And that's 0.5. Previous slide, we reached 0.25 with 8 Plato. Here, lower starting gravity, twice as much ethanol produced. So you can see the difference right there immediately between these two strains that LA01 is more efficient at producing ethanol, LA02 less. But the selection process goes beyond that. So it's not just the ethanol production or the efficiency there. But we're on the efficiency part right now. So here's LA02 from 8 up to 14 Plato. And even at 14 Plato, we're still not reaching 0.5 ABV. So it's really a non-efficient fermenter from carbohydrate to ethanol in the fermentation. Also, what we'll do is we'll track fermentations like these fermentations of the different gravities and see how influential that starting gravity is on the length of fermentation. so that we can give you advice and say, look, with LA01, you're reaching that plateau at about 3 days, 70, 72 hours, 75 hours, somewhere in that window. And that's interesting and that's important, especially with non-alcoholic beer, because, again, you have all of that maltose, all the maltotriose still remaining in the beer, and the rest of your little friends that are floating around the brewery or maybe in soft materials and gaskets and hoses would be very happy if they got into that tank and there isn't enough ethanol to deter them. Ethanol is a very good protection for microorganisms. And there's all the maltose and maltotriose available. So we tested, we saw this, we've seen it repeatedly. We've had customers, we've had labs that are very intellectual that used LA01 8 years ago when we were just releasing that. And they said, yeah, we started the fermentation on a Wednesday, and then we saw it was at terminal on Friday, and then we let it rest over the weekend, and they came back in on Monday, and it was at 3.5%. And I was like, yeah, that's a big no-no. You can't just leave this over the weekend because it's so fragile in terms of having a different yeast that's already in your brewery implant and just take off like crazy. So this is LA01. Here's the LA02 information. So again, less efficient at fermentation and actually takes slightly longer to reach that plateau. So here we're looking at about 4 days of fermentation, where LA01 was 3 days. Still a rather fast fermentation, in my opinion. But really plateauing after that four-day mark. Something else that's really interesting is we do these analysis to see when the fermentation occurs, how normalized it is in terms of a fermentation curve. And then we can take those numbers, and what we try to do is give you as much information as we can quickly on just characteristics of the strain. So with LA01, we tested and we did a linear regression. It was a one value, so perfectly linear. So that means the more gravity you give it, the more ethanol is produced over time. So it's a one-to-one. It's a straight linear line. So as long as you're delivering the same carbohydrate profile at the same gravity, it'll hit that target, the end of fermentation, the same every time. With LA02, again, very close, but here we put in some buffering because of the ethanol being so significantly lower. And when you have that buffer, you start to see that it isn't perfectly linear, but it's pretty darn close. So again, very, very easy to predict the ethanol produced during these fermentations based on a linear regression. Of course, this depends on your mash regime, on the diastatic power of the malt, on if you include exogenous ingredients, different grains, fruit. I was just talking to somebody at our booth earlier today, and he produces a lower strength mead. He said 6.2 to 6.9%. And he was saying, you know, what options do I have for that? And I got into kind of a lengthy discussion with him because I said, okay, according to my understanding of honey, and I'm not a honey expert, I'm just in the process of acquiring bees for my yard because I think it'd be awesome to make my own honey in my yard. Well, to steal my own honey from the bees in my yard. But, you know, from the standpoint of a raw material, honey is primarily simple sugars. But honey also can have dextrins present, unfermentable by any yeast, which is going to give you more mouthfeel, more body to whatever product it is. So I said, okay, I don't know how LA01, LA02, how lager yeasts are going to react in a honey-based fermentation to 6%. I said, most likely you'll have very similar attenuation every time, but the flavor profile, I have no idea. And it's interesting when you have a customer like that that's curious and nobody has an answer to the question, because we've come out with two strains for mead production, but those are for full-strength mead, Kevin Mead, some of the Dizzy Juice. But he's talking about 6%. I said, honestly, I have no idea. I mean, I'll be happy to send you samples. If you can give me some feedback, that'd be great. But here, again, with it being simple sugar from a malt base, you can basically predict the 10 to 15% available for the yeast. and then have a reliable fermentation every time after that. I apologize, I go on tangents sometimes, and hopefully it doesn't happen this time, but I sometimes get lost and I forget where I started, and then I have to like think hard and backtrack. But so we've talked a little bit about that Swiss cheese layering, right? So in beer, we're very fortunate. I'm a former brewer myself. I used to work for the second largest brewery in the United States, running their pilot brewery. That was 15 to 20 years ago now. I've been a yeast guy since. Sounds weird. Don't really consider myself a yeast guy. But, you know, brewers were very fortunate because you have many layers built into the beer. You have ethanol. You have reduced carbohydrate profile. You have the biostability of hops added. And all three of those are going to be deterring other organisms from implanting. Can it still happen? Of course. Of course, other organisms can still implant and create different flavor, different attenuation. The other thing that brewers are very fortunate about is the pH drop. And that pH drop is occurring because of the fermentation process. It's not because you make a beer and you start at 5.2, whatever pH, that it always goes down to a 4.2, 4.1, something. I don't know. It depends on your beer. But when you have a maltose-negative fermentation, you don't have that fermentation. You don't have that drop in pH. And that's a very good bioprotectant. So in a non-alcoholic fermentation, where normally you'd go from a 5.2, let's say, down to a 4.2, I'm just kind of ballparking it. Here you go from a 5.2 down to a 4.75, 4.8, 4.9, something like that. And it's incredibly important to understand that adjusting the pH, number one, helps stabilize the beer, and number two, helps the beer become palatable, become something that we're used to. And a great understanding of this was the equivalent of me for Europe, Middle East, and Africa. He put together a small research program at our campus because we also have an internal taste panel that's trained for everything. And he said, okay, very simple, let's take a non-alcoholic beer and let's adjust the pH and see not if people think the beer is good or bad, but where in the spectrum do you find it to be most similar to beer, the most palatable? That just so happens to be somewhere between 3.8 and 4.2 pH. And his example that he gave when kind of proposing this research study is if you had a glass of water, just Kirkland original water, and you added 113 grams of sucrose to it, you'd have roughly the same sugar, the equivalent sugar amount that's in a soda. But the sugar water is going to be a much higher pH. Sodas are palatable. It's incredible how much soda people drink in the world. I wrote it off quite a while ago and switched to my good buddy ethanol instead, which isn't healthy either. But when you think about it, other than flavor, what's the difference between a soda and a glass of sugar water? It's the pH. So having that drop in pH actually balances the sweetness, balances the sugar load that you're taking in a sip, therefore making it more palatable. So you have two benefits to one adjustment with pH. You could do it with lactic or citric. I think the company that makes a bunch of NA beer these days, just NA beer, I think they do kind of blends of different acids because each of them will play differently on the palate. I don't know the answers to these. I don't know what the right combo is, and it's up to you to try to find the right combo for your beverage, but certainly there's pH adjustment to make the beer more palatable. Water. Or maybe it's vodka. You know, the old high school trick. I'm just drinking some water. So, again, you're not having a really strong fermentation. The result of that is a higher pH. You should adjust it because, number one, it's not going to be palatable. Number two, when you get down to 4.2, usually that's like the ballpark for food safety. If you go lower, it's even more preservative. the acid that is in the beer. So dropping the pH, definitely something that should be on your radar. You should think about that when you're making non-alcoholic beer. One big difference between the LE01, our first release 8 years ago, and the LE02, the release official, I guess, yesterday, is the profile of the beer. So when Fermentis came out with LE01, we wanted to introduce something that produced flavor, that made an impression on the beer, because at the time, that's kind of the direction that we were taking. Also, the fact that it's Saccharomyces cerevisiae and not in non-sac makes it easier to get into the bigger guys. I can tell you stories, not here, because I don't want to waste all of your time. I'll just waste part of it. But, yeah, the industrial producers definitely have rules against POF-positive strains, killer-positive strains, non-Saccharomyces, blah, blah, blah. So we came out with the Saccharomyces cerevisiae variety Chevaliari because it's applicable in most breweries, and it has a very intense character for the small fermentation that's occurring. That's great, but in today's world, let's be honest, it's better as a yeast to not produce as much character. It's more approachable by the general public. Typically, if you have too much flavor, people are turned away. So we said, okay, we'll come out with a second one, and that happens to be the Torulospora, and it's POF negative, really doesn't have a strong fermentation flavor in this small fermentation. Going back to the guy that came up and talked to me about mead, Torulospora is known in wine for enhancing the flavor of the fermentation. Why is that? Well, in wine you have so much more carbohydrate that's simplified, simple sugars for the yeast to ferment, that you have that much more fermentation occurring, therefore more flavor production by the strain. So in one scenario we're saying it's very relatively neutral in fermentation character, but you change the media. Okay, hope, I don't know, anybody make wine in here? I do at home, which is like the cheating way to do it, but in wine you have so much more sugar available that you actually have an enhancement of flavor coming from the strain. The LA02 is POF negative, so there you can see on the screen the 4VG and 4VP are significantly below threshold value. For each of those, the threshold of 4VG is roughly 300 ppm, or sorry, ppb, and 4VP is around 200, give or take. Probably 10 or 20. Now, what we did was we put the two strains, the two beers, through a pair test. So I'm not terribly familiar with the pair test. I'm more familiar with standard taste panel practices. But essentially with the pair test, what we were trying to do is say, on a scale, on a full spectrum of 12, which one is displaying more of that characteristic? So it isn't saying that yes, this is malty. No, that's not malty. It's just a balance of, on a 12-point scale, where do you put the marker for the amount of the larger production, the amount of larger appreciation versus the smaller one. So you can see that some of these, like the citrusy and malty, are slightly more balanced in terms of the two. But then there's certainly others like sourness or phenolics. Clovey, there it is. Sorry, I was looking for the wrong word. Clovey, sour, that are extreme one way, where you only have a score of 1 for the LA02 and you have a score of 11 for the LA01. That should make sense to you. One is POF positive, one is POF negative. There's going to be more sourness from the LA01 than the LA02. There's going to be a more, so this is written strangely because it says sweet. It's not sweet, it's sweetness perception. There's more sweetness perception from the LA02 than the LA01. You can see that there's differences in honey notes, citrus notes, malty notes, but those are going to be more balanced between the two. Not that they're perfectly balanced, but you're going to have some character coming from either of the strains, and that's where you start to see that the bars aren't that as different as they could be. Oops. Turned off the screen on you. So we've talked a couple of different times about those protection layers, the Swiss cheese that you're building up to protect this beer in that non-alcoholic character, in the flavor of the beer that you want to deliver to your customer. I don't think any of you would want a surprise of something cross-contaminating and developing flavor that you weren't predicting or that you didn't taste originally. Dropping the pH by adding acid, maybe increasing the hopping to have more IBU as a protective layer. But none of those are super concrete, and there is no one solution. But when it comes to preserving the beer in a package, pasteurization does a pretty good job. I know that craft breweries traditionally didn't do much pasteurization. I think there's more acceptance to it. I think that there's innovations happening constantly. The size of a batch pasteurizer went from a monstrous mess to now it's they have mobile pasteurizers that go around similar to mobile canning. They can come around, pasteurize your beer, and then they leave with their truck. But that really is the best protection for the beer when you have non-alcoholic, maltose-negative fermented beer. When Fermentis comes out with this information, we want to test it, and we want to apply true meaning to these pasteurization standards. If you research through, I'm not sure ASBC has an exact amount. I know the EBC does have a range, and they say for non-alcoholic beer, so 0.5 or less, 80 to 120 pasteurization units is needed. That's extreme. For you to understand, an industrial lager usually goes through like 15 to 20 PU. And for NA beer, it's 80 to 120 is what the recommended guideline is from EBC. So really, you're cooking the beer. But it's to preserve the beer so that you're delivering the same beer to your customer every time. You don't have contamination. You don't have flavor development over time. You don't have ethanol production over time. You're keeping that non-alcoholic beer non-alcoholic when you deliver it to your customer. So Fermentis did this trial where we set up a primary fermentation with LA02, maltose negative, at 25 degrees C. We did find that you can use it down to 15 degrees C, but the metabolism rate that you have from yeast is always going to be dependent on the temperature of fermentation. So when you go too low, when you go low, you're going to have a very slow fermentation. The more temperature you increase, the faster the metabolism, the faster you have the beer, hopefully not affecting the flavor too much. So we took a beer in our pilot brewery. We fermented with LA02 at 25 degrees, centrifuged. We cross-contaminate on purpose with T58. So T58 is, Saville T58 is one of our strains from our brewing portfolio. And the reason we select that strain is the parent company, Lesaf, knows the thermotolerance of all of our strains. I don't. You could ask me, but I'll tell you I don't know what that is. But T58 is the most thermotolerant strain in our brewing portfolio. So we're using it, worst case scenario, to cross-contaminate and then to check pasteurization. With it, we were pasteurizing at 63 degrees C. So pasteurization traditionally happens at 60 degrees. That's the benchmark. 63, you just accelerate the pasteurization. So again, we're talking about higher pasteurization for this NA beer. And in order to not sit there for 80 minutes to 120 minutes, what you need with 60 degree pasteurization, you're able to have that accelerate and you're able to move the beer through faster. With it, we did pasteurization trials at 25, 50, 75, and 100 PU, and then we did plating on YPD media, and then the important thing about this is it doesn't really matter what grows. We don't care. We're trying to eliminate all microbes in activity from that beer to make sure that there's nothing growing anymore. So here you can see there's three charts here. It's 1,000 cells per milliliter, 10,000 cells per milliliter, and 100,000 cells per milliliter. And in each case, we see cell growth at 25, at 50, of course at zero. That doesn't really make sense to have there. That's the concentration from the initial pitch. But once you get above 50 pasteurization units, you no longer see growth on the plates. What does that mean? That means you're mostly going to be safe beyond 50 pasteurization units. I can only say that because we test with a cross-contamination from internal cultures, and that doesn't mean that there isn't other yeast or different microbes that might have a slightly higher tolerance. But you're pretty safe once you get above 50 PU. And we saw that same thing with LA01. It was just, I think at 50 PU, we didn't even see growth. So we said, okay, with that 50 PU, you're fine. Here with LA02, you have to go a little bit higher. Again, you don't have as much ethanol present from that fermentation. You don't have that layer of Swiss cheese, even if it's a very thin slice of Swiss cheese. You're removing layers by removing ethanol, by removing the pH drop that you have during fermentation. So again, it's a different beast. If you're not making NA beer, I encourage you to sit down, really think about the process, think about how you can do this in your brewery and what steps you can take to make an NA beer and to preserve that NA beer for your customer. So from this research that we've done, we've come up with kind of recommendations for the use. So it's 50 to 80 gram per hectoliter. I think that number could be refined because you only have that small portion of fermentation. You probably don't need a huge load of yeast, but at initial release, we're saying 50 to 80 grams per hectoliter. You can directly pitch. We've tested that. We test that with every product that we come out with. If you can rehydrate it in wort or if it's preferable in water, or one thing that we continuously find is that it's not good to rehydrate dry yeast in an ethanol solution, so don't do that. If you're going to add yeast to bottle condition or to carry out a secondary fermentation, it's best to rehydrate in a water or wort and then add it to the beer that has ethanol. And the reason being is that the ethanol kind of disrupts the fluidity of the membrane during rehydration and kills some of the yeast. So don't add yeast to ethanol unless it's rehydrated. You can also sprinkle yeast in 10 times its weight of sterile water. And if you conclude hopping, it's not going to affect the yeast at all. It's just going to be another preservative layer that you're adding to the beer. So I don't know how you do that, if you prepare a hop solution beforehand, or you could just use wort from a different batch of beer to rehydrate it and then add in. As long as you're conscious of the carbohydrate load going in, it's not going to be that much because it's 1 to 10 for the weight of the liquid to the yeast that you're adding. Yeast is not often added in high quantities. I'm still looking for a brewer, if any of you want to try this. I think we should come out with in line with like a New England IPA, but instead of like just dumping a bunch of hops in at the end, we just do yeast and just like force ferment overnight and you have a beer. I'll take your business cards later if you want to do that trial with me. I joke. I just think it's funny when I see like the weight of hops that people add to New England IPAs is incredible. You don't need to aerate the wort. In our production process, it's fully aerobic. So we go right from propagation to drying. So we're actually preserving the yeast in that really high status with all of the sterols present, all the unsaturated fatty acids that the yeast need for growth. So you don't need to aerate, especially with this scenario, because you don't want to encourage other micro from growing, which is what oxygen is going to do if it's dissolved. It's recommended to be between 20 and 25 degrees for fermentation, 25°C, so 68 to 77 Fahrenheit. And you should expect the fermentation to be complete in 3 to 4 days, more likely 4±. Again, it's a little bit slower. It takes a little bit more time than the LA01, but very consistent in terms of ethanol production versus gravity. One thing that we had to have long discussions on between people in my position in R&D was how do we recommend the usage of dry hopping for IPAs that are NA? And you're all fortunate that now there's a lot of flowable extracts that you can use that have the enzymatic character removed from them. So you're not going to have hop creep from those typically because they go through some sort of concentration, either distillation or something that you're denaturing the enzyme. But if you're going to be using pellets or cones, that's when you have to be mindful that you could have hop creep, which again, it's going to be producing more simple sugar available for the yeast, more ethanol production. It's no longer non-alcoholic beer. Just some quick last points of attention. The apparent degree of fermentation should be about 10%. We do say that pasteurizing the package is mandatory, and that's for health and safety reasons. none of you really want to have a bottle explode or something, or a can explode and hurt somebody, whether that's one of your employees or yourself or your customer. None of those are good scenarios. And you should expect that the pH is going to be somewhere between 4.5 and 5 at the end of fermentation. We saw that on the previous slide. And again, adjusting that is going to make the beer more palatable. It'll make it a more drinkable beer when you drop it down somewhere below 4.2, but above 3.8, because if you go too low, then it's going to be sour, and that's not what you're looking for in a beer, unless you're trying to make a sour, in which case, go crazy like you always do. We do not recommend cropping and repitching, and that's because, again, you have this very delicate environment. And again, typical Saccharomyces, whether it's Pastorianus or Cerevisiae, are going to be very happy in that high maltose environment. And if you accidentally get some in on the first batch and then you harvest and put it into a second tank, it's going to be very happy and it's going to produce more ethanol than you'd like. And you probably shouldn't propagate also for the same reason. Of course we want to sell more yeast. That's our business. That's how we make money. Similar to you probably wanting to sell more beer because that's your business and that's how you make money. These are more health and safety related than because we want to sell more yeast. So concluding with this slide, I'll touch on the next slide, but this is really just screenshot for applying this to a beer. Again, if you're starting at 8 Plato, you should have roughly 0.2 to 0.25 ABV from that. The attenuation should be less than 10%, give or take. You can ferment as low as 15 up to 25. Similar flavor profile throughout. You're just going to be affecting the rate of metabolism of the yeast. So for a four-day fermentation, I'd tailor more to the higher end. But if you've got tank space and free time and you want to let it sit there for a week, you could go lower. Be my guest. Not many brewers want to do that, though. Pitch rate should be about 50 gram per hectoliter. Again, I think that can be further investigated. I'm not saying that you should pitch less. I'm just saying I think fermentus needs to look at it more thoroughly and see if you drop that pitch rate lower, does that negatively affect the fermentation? You should have no off-flavor development with this product. You do need to pasteurize somewhere between 50 and 100 PPU, and that's something that takes trial and error. At least 50, because we saw that there was still a little bit of growth at 50 PU, but once you're above that, you didn't see any. So safer to go a little bit higher. Don't repitch, don't referment. Refermentation is always a funny thing when I'm doing a non-alcoholic beer talk, because the intention is to not produce more ethanol. And when you bottle condition, the primary target is CO2, but the byproduct is ethanol. So be mindful. This product is available in all package sizes. That's why I said I only just touch on this briefly. So that's all the information I have. Please, if you have any questions, you can either come grab a mic or you can listen to my voice more because I have to repeat the question so that they can capture it on the audio. So thank you. Questions, comments, concerns? Is everybody as thirsty for a traditional beer as I am? Yeah.
So if you had a sour IPA or something like that, something where you're acidifying or knocked out, what's the pH tolerance so that you're not completely stopped?
So the question is the pH tolerance of the LA02? It's a great question. Typically, and I don't know specifically for LA02, but typically you can drop the pH before fermentation because you're not going that extreme, hopefully. You're not going down to like 1. But, I mean, if you're – typically you'll be in the 4s, maybe upper 3s. The yeast should be able to handle that. I don't think we've done research yet specifically analyzing that, so I can't guarantee it. But I would say I would be comfortable in the 4s. If you get too low, then maybe there could be some – not adjustment, but some change in the fermentation performance. And it's not going to be that it won't ferment, it just will take longer. That's what we've seen. So we did some trials, I want to say 5 years ago, where we were doing kettle souring, and then we tested all of our yeast at the time in a kettle soured wort. And USO5, which is it's our largest seller, was the only one that was really sensitive to lactic and acetic acid. And it wasn't that it didn't finish the fermentation, it was just that it kind of elongated the leg phase, and then that set you back a day in fermentation, and then it finished. But I think with the lagers also, the higher level of lactic acid from a kettle souring also slowed it down about a day, but they all finished in the end. You had a question? No, but I love where your head's at. So the question was about co-pitching LA01 and LA02. Absolutely, yeah. So I truly, honestly appreciate the question because we do a traveling educational series where we go around. Now it's around the world in countries everywhere. But I'm fortunate that in the U.S. and in the Americas, sometimes they give me the chance to just talk for extended periods of time. And I have there's an application inside of PowerPoint that you can make. It's called Slide View, I think. And you can make title slides, and then I let the attendees choose their own path. So I just say which topic do you want to talk about? There's 12 on screen. I click on that one and I go. One of the topics is co-inoculation, and I think it's an undervalued operation. You know, you think about 200 years ago, every beer had multiple strains and bacteria and everything in it. And then we got to the point that we said, okay, hyper-focus, just single isolates that we use for the beer, which is much more predictable. But then, you know, I always ask, how many beers do you make that's just one hop? Just one hop variety. How many beers do you make that's just one malt variety? And then how many beers do you make that are just one yeast strain? And that's most of them, if not all. So I think there's a lot to venture and to experiment with. The hard thing is from the supplier side, we can't test all of the options and we can't test every ratio of this strain and that strain. I do it all the time at home. I just did one a couple weeks ago and I smelled it, but in between Chile and here, I was home for 36 hours and I had to wash my clothes and repack and pretend like I'm still a dad to my children for 36 hours. But when I get home, I'll be most likely enjoying that beverage. So we haven't tried it. I encourage you guys to think about that. You know, you have the subset, you have the outline of what the strains can do. When you start to mix them, it's not a 1 + 1 = 2. It's like a 1 + 1 = 1¾. It's really strange. But yeah, I think you could do it. We just don't have any trials done on it. Yep.
What I found when I have a 8-mega gravity, when it's done fermenting, it tastes like bull sugar. You know, and it does not taste like beer.
Yep.
So, what is your recommendation as far as the grain bill for your process?
So, the question is, sorry, let me just summarize quick. The beer at the end of fermentation is sweet like a bowl of sugar, and my recommendation for a malt bill for an NA beer. Correct? Malt bill for the NA beer?
Yeah.
It's not an easy question to answer. No, because, I mean, okay, you look at the world of craft beer, and if you just walk into that trade show, you could probably have 700 different beers. And I would say that at least half of them are called IPA, but none of them are the same IPA. So there's so much complexity. I mean, and that's where brewers, so I was a brewer. I'm still a home brewer. I started as the guy in charge of North America for sales. Then we hired a wine woman from the West Coast, and I started talking to her. And she started as a wine woman. She almost became just a beer woman, but then something came up that gave her an opportunity to go just to wine. She's the equivalent of me, but for wine in North America, or for the Americas. But we had long discussions about recipe development and raw material selection. Because as a winemaker, you spend 3/4 of the year growing the grapes that you're then going to ferment once in the year. And you don't have that many options of malts, of different toasts, of different caramelization or crystallization or Munich or Vienna or you name it, wheat or oats. There's so many options just from the malt side. And then the next layer is hops. And you have how many different hop varieties. And every year it seems like there's 10 more from every company that are experimental hops. Or, you know, I just heard of from, I think it was at Haas, that they had a new hop variety from the Southern Hemisphere. I don't remember if it was Australian or New Zealand. It's one of those two. That really displays a different character. And sorry, I'm going on a tangent again. Back to your question. I think the best is to start simple. Start simple. I think what you're tasting is the lack of the pH adjustment. Oh, it's 3.8. And you still think it's sweet. Yeah.
I was just seeing what you said, what your thoughts were as a professional.
I mean, for me, when you're doing recipe development, it's always better to start very basic and build upon that.
It took me 6 tries.
Yeah.
The 6 on barrel batch turned out.
And it still tastes like a bowl of cereal?
No.
Okay.
No.
Well, then you tell me, what is the right recipe? You've got the answer. Why are you asking me?
I just wanted your thoughts.
Raw. Sure.
You will not get the sugars down low enough. It will always taste like cold syrup. I had, on one of my attempts, I had an original gravity of 019. Used volume on the same.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really interesting, now that you said the alternative grains or raw grains, Scott LaFontaine, who's at the University of Arkansas, is currently working really heavily on rice, and I attended a talk of his, I think it was in St. Louis, MBA St. Louis, and he was explaining that by incorporating rice into a non-alcoholic beer, you can actually build the mouthfeel and not the sweetness. So I believe you that raw or alternative grains could be a solution for at least removing part of that. Maybe not the whole thing, but
I just want to understand that I've heard a lot of beer.
I would argue that it's not actually beer.
Well, sure.
To me, it's food. And that's a whole nother story that we could talk about that you're working with in beer, with TTB, with food, with FDA. And I don't know that every brewery that's making an NA is certified by FDA. But there's also other tricks you can do because it's a food and not a beer, you have different options for what you can add to it. I questioned that last week, or I don't know when it was, sometime not too distant past. I was like, can children go and buy non-alcoholic beer? Or like when it's 0.0, can children go and buy 0.0 beer? Because the ruling is on alcohol, and if there's no alcohol, then it's... But it'd be weird to see a kid, like a 5-year-old, walk out of a store with a 6-pack of Heineken 0.0 and just be like, yeah! That's where I was kind of going with the food type product, because I think it's federal that it's a food product, not a beer. And because of that, that's why it falls under FDA, but then that opens the door for preservatives, and you don't have to label contain sulfites, I don't think. I don't know specifically. I haven't gotten that deep into it. It's just like things that, because I'm on the Food and Brewery Safety Committee, and then, you know, I do research for these types of presentations that I've done so many talks on NA beer, and it's really not my thing.
Like, why makes you thirsty for a real beer?
100%. The more non-alcoholic, the more non-alcoholic, the better for me right now. Yeah, I mean, there are also there's some fungal extracts that you can add that are preservative characteristics. I think they come out of, like, Northern Europe. I'd have to look into it because I haven't talked about that for a while. But there's different preservative stabilizers that you can use that in replacement or in conjunction with pasteurizing. Anybody else? Or are you sick of hearing about, oh, yeah, still want some more? The question is it legal to produce NA beer without pasteurization? Yes, 100%. But, okay, there's two answers to the question. I'm safety-minded. I'm part of the safety committee for MBAA, so I try to side on the safety side. Plus, I don't want people to get injured or to have problems that they don't need to have. So from the supplier side, pasteurization is mandatory. From application, you don't need to. There's no rule that says you have to. It's just another protective layer for you as a brewery. But, I don't want to scare you from not producing NA beer. I've said it a few times that this media, this beer, at the end is going to be very satisfactory for Saccharomyces. I'm not confident, but I'm 100% confident that the contamination in your brewery is not going to be a food pathogen. It's going to be Saccharomyces. And that's actually a benefit to you. Why? In the process of fermentation, you have two byproducts. Well, more than two, but two main byproducts. Ethanol, and bigger is CO2. Because CO2 is something that you'll notice the second you pour a beer. If it's more carbonated than it was yesterday, let's take a look at it and see if it's more carbonated, because if you have more carbonation, that means that something's fermenting. It's a safety blanket that you have built into your brewery accidentally. I don't want anybody to get hurt, and that could be the outcome of overcarbonation, because if you package wort, which is essentially this, with a little bit of alcohol, there's going to be a lot of CO2 buildup. But it's advantageous because you have that warning sign when you open the product, when you pour it. If you're serving it to a customer and it's foaming everywhere, you say, sorry, the NA beer is not available today. So I don't like the scare tactics that have been put out into the public, because a lot of them are talking about pathogens, foodborne pathogens, which, sure, it could happen. But do you know how those labs test that? They have to have certification to bring in food pathogens into their lab to purposely inoculate an NA beer. Hopefully you're not adding raw chicken to your beer. I don't think most people are. I hope nobody does. But you have to have a source of that foodborne pathogen for it to implant and grow. And really, the more common problem will be over attenuation, more CO2, more ethanol. And that's a pretty good warning sign, because if you have it bottled or kegged, you'll see that in the serving. So I hope that answers your question. Don't be afraid. I think you should experiment with it. You know, you can talk to people at the fermenters booth. You can talk to chemical suppliers and find if there's a stabilizer that would be better for you. You can find out what the right ad rate is, because I'm sure that chemical companies or whoever's offering the different products have tested in an NA beer, because it is currently the largest growing segment in the craft community. You're welcome. Any other questions? Otherwise, I'm signing off, and I'm going to go have some traditional beer. So this is recorded. It should be available through the BA, I believe. If not, come to our booth, and I can give you the information. We're right inside the middle doors. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we're still in the adolescence for NA beer and how to serve it, how to preserve it, how to do all these things, because when I was brewing, it was certainly cold contact or halted fermentation. And if you remember 15, 20 years ago, you'd have an NA. Okay, I worked for one of the big guys. They had it, and I was on their global taste panel, so I had to taste it. And the second I received that glass and I smelled it, I was like, tomato soup, this is NA beer, guaranteed. But we're fortunate now that companies like Fermentis and Lallemand and whoever are supplying the micro to do it and have the quality standards to deliver that without cross-contamination. Thank you all for coming. Appreciate it.